An unsettling pattern has emerged in the aftermath of national tragedies like the school shooting in Parkland, Florida. Survivors and victims' families are grieving the loss of their loved ones, but these days they're also the targets of a wave of vitriol aimed directly at them.
They are often harassed online or in person by conspiracy theorists who often think the whole thing was a hoax. Take the March arrest of two people outside of the Sutherland Springs, Texas church where 26 people were murdered in 2017. The pair confronted the church pastor whose daughter was killed, saying the murders never happened and his daughter never lived. They called him a crisis actor. This type of incident isn't isolated to Sutherland Springs, though, or to the two people arrested there. So first I turned to Joseph Uzinski, a political science associate professor at the University of Miami who studies conspiracy theorists, to find out what his data says about these people and why they believe what they do.
So many big events have conspiracy theories tied to them, and many of them suggest that that event is fake. These things have been going on for a long time. The crisis actor meme started largely after Sandy Hook, where there were conspiracy theorists who believed that the media coverage was fake and had included actors who were paid by FEMA to go and pretend to be the victims of shootings. And in the aftermath of this, conspiracy theorists harassed the families of the dead children. They sent mail to them asking them to notarize that the children actually existed. Some people committed, in-person violence and harassment against the families, and some, have gone to jail, I think, at this point.
Wow. How widespread is this?
So it happens quite a bit, and it's going on with the shooting in Texas at the church. It's going on with the Parkland shooting. So it goes on. Now, it's easy to say, oh, this is all about the conspiracy theories, but a lot of people believe in conspiracy theories. Polls show that about 20% of the country thinks that events like this are staged for one reason or another, but you don't have 20% of the country harassing victims. Instead, it's a very small number of people. And I think when the conspiracy theories are that strong that they lead to action, it's not so much the conspiracy beliefs, but it's other things going on in the person's mind. And there's probably, a proneness, to delusions.
Did you say 20%? That's not an insignificant amount.
No, and it's spread evenly between both parties. So as easy as it is to say, oh, it's a bunch of right-wing NRA people who are spreading these conspiracy theories, there's skepticism of this from both parties.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit about why. You've said before that they are, quote unquote, losers because literally, like, their candidate lost or the economy was doing badly and they lost their fortune, things like that. What's behind that theory?
Conspiracy theories make really great narratives for losers because they get to paint an enemy, and it's easy to paint an enemy when that enemy is very powerful. So when you look over time, what you find is that depending on who the party in power is, that tends to drive most of the conspiracy theorizing. So when Bush was in power, it was Bush did 9/11, Dick Cheney, Halliburton, Blackwater, all of these things. When Obama took over, then we were concerned about Barack Obama's birth certificate and him doing Sandy Hook and him being a secret Muslim. And now that Trump's president, now it's Trump Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So as power swings, so do the general contours of conspiracy theories. But with these shootings, there is a sort of a different dynamic, and that is that it's not just about power, it's about threat. So you do wind up pulling in a lot of gun-supporting people into these theories just simply because they feel like they're threatened with losing gun rights.
Right, and we are seeing this now with the survivors of the Parkland shooting.
We are, and it's very easy to see it online. So you see people attacking them. You see a lot of accusations saying that the Parkland students are crisis actors. Some suggest that David Hogg, who's one of the main student activists, actually graduated from high school in California a few years ago, and he's just an actor playing a role now.
So how do we, when we look at this issue, balance free speech, but also where does that line draw? How do we protect victims of tragedy?
We get into very murky territory when we want to say, okay, let's go ban conspiracy theories. Because then we're giving a lot of power to powerful institutions. I mean, conspiracy theories are used to balance against power imbalances. So right now you have the Democrats out of power, and they've largely turned to conspiracy theories to accuse the Trump administration. The Republicans did it to accuse Obama of doing all sorts of things while he was in office. If we take that away, what we're really doing is taking away political speech. Now, there are already laws on the books to protect against harassment, and I think those need to be enforced, particularly online. But to ban the speech outright, I think, may make things a lot worse. It may put us in a very bad situation.
Right. It sounds like from what you're saying, you see this almost as a function of our society.
It's very important that we be able to question authoritative narratives and be able to question power.
Right.
It's not important that we harass the parents of dead victims. One thing I would say to conspiracy theorists is consider just for a moment that you might be wrong. And if that's the case, then you would not want to go and harass the parents of dead children or harass teenagers who just had their friends shot. What's a better strategy is that you protest our large institutions, because they're already protected and they're designed to handle protest and questioning.
All right. Joseph Usinski is a professor of political science at the University of Miami. Joseph, thanks so much for joining us to talk about this today.
You're very welcome.
No one knows the pain of this type of harassment that can and what it can wield on a grieving family more than Lenny Posner. His son Noah was the youngest child murdered at Sandy Hook Elementary in 2012. Since that day, he has had to deal with, deflect, outmaneuver, and confront what he calls hoaxers, people set on revealing that he is part of a vast conspiracy from the government. To combat this, he started the Honor Foundation to raise awareness of this type of harassment for other families of victims.
The conspiracy theories, I became aware of them very quickly. Now, for the first couple of weeks after the tragedy, I wasn't looking at any media. I wasn't even logging onto the web and doing any searches on news. But as soon as I did that in January, I noticed that there was the talk of crisis actors, and that was already going on.
What was your reaction to that?
Well, I was—I mean, I was definitely pissed off at the time, but I wasn't surprised. I had heard of all of these types of theories. I just never had them directed at me directly, and so that was very different. But I wasn't surprised about seeing it.
So you found out these theories are out there, but this also has been really tough in your own life. Like, describe for us, how have you had to change your life as a result of this?
Well, because I started to push back with some of the comments that were being said, some of the videos that were being posted, I made myself a bigger target than I originally was. And being trolled, I needed to sort of protect my privacy a little bit more. I would get my mail at a P.O. box. I would be very careful about having my address posted, but they would still do background checks on me and they'd determine where I'd live. So I'd have to move. I've moved frequently.
I guess the thing that strikes me about this is you've already had to suffer this terrible tragedy with the loss of your son at such a young age, and then to compound that, you've had to deal with all of this, these hoaxers, as you called them, afterward. And you're not the only one, obviously. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm accustomed to it now, but it certainly is not a very not a comfortable place to be. There seems to be no safety net, so that when you fall through, bottom, you just keep going. And the web is largely unregulated, so this manifests in so many different ways, from attacking and trolling. It's this mob hate momentum that goes on the web.
Were you surprised by the fact that you couldn't really do anything to stop it? Like you said, it's pretty unregulated.
I was at first. I was pretty surprised, and I was surprised at how much the police is really not interested. The police would generally say, just turn off the computer. They don't really want to deal with any of this, and they don't know how to deal with some of this. They don't really understand it. And then at the same time, they don't connect how stressful it could be for someone who's already been traumatized, and now they're being re-traumatized by trolls that are getting some sort of dark pleasure in doing this.
Are there existing laws that can be used to try to stop this kind of harassment?
Well, it depends on how extreme the harassment is, and if it goes to the point of making threats. So there was a woman who was arrested for making death threats against me. But if they're if the threats are very vague, if the harassment is along the lines of posting photos of where you live, posting your personal information, that's not against the law. So I've filed multiple police reports, and usually the reports are not pursued by the police. And I've even spoken to state's attorney's offices, and most of the time, they're not breaking the law. So right. There are not enough laws.
This is tricky territory, though, legally, right, with the First Amendment. So for you, when do you think free speech sort of crosses over into harassment here?
Well, my understanding of free speech is that that has to do with an open press or to criticize your government. That's not to sort of attack victims.
So is there any recourse? Is there anything that you've been able to do with this foundation that you've created or working with other victims to try to ease this?
Well, one of the things that we've been doing is we have been removing online content. It's harassing content. Different platforms that host this content have a variety of different rules, and so we see when those rules are violated. So they have terms of service and acceptable use policies. One of the long-term plans that we have is to make platforms more aware that the group that's being targeted is or should be a protected group or a protected class, because victims need to be recognized as they have a category for disabled, so maybe that would apply. So that's one of the avenues we've taken also.
You said that because you spoke out about this, you made yourself more visible and more targeted in this. Do you think that's been worth it, though? Do you feel like this work has been important?
I think the work is very important. I don't measure how much worth it has compared to how it's disrupted my life. They have attacked the memory of my son. I think it's definitely been worth it.
What do you want people to know about him?
He was a regular 6-year-old kid. He was a happy boy that went to school one morning and was in his classroom.
Len Posner, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.